You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Now I give the floor to Georgina. Georgina, you take your example in Argentina. You are a lecturer in the Institute of Social Studies in Rotterdam. Erasmus University Rotterdam. You have published on alternative economic spaces, local development, and various aspects of the Argentine complementary currency systems. I think it's very, it's a real challenge to explain what happens in Argentina within, let's try to stick to 15 minutes. This from my point of view, your example comes from Argentina, but you raise really a sort of universal question through this example, and you will talk about talk us about community currency system in Argentina from 1995 to 2002, and you will show the importance of trust and interpersonal relationship. So you have the floor.
Yeah, thanks, Nicole. Can I have the remote, please? The remote control. Ah, yes. Thank you very much. So thanks, Nicole, and thanks to the organizers of this conference for the opportunity to share my work. My paper will address mainly the E in the social and solidarity economy, that is, the economic effects and the process. It will not go into the details of how these redes de trueque, that's how we called it in Argentina, how it grew, why it grew, why it's so special, how do community and complementary currencies work, how they affect the poor and local development. All these topics have been dealt with and published elsewhere by a variety of authors. What this paper will do in particular is to analyze the process of scaling up. And that's a point on which the redes de trueque, that's, like I said, I will call them by their name from now on, they are terribly unique, because most of the systems of complementary and community currency systems are very small. Most of the schemes around the world have a few hundred members, and the Argentine experience was terribly different in this sense of scale. So, Well, to start with, when we discuss social and solidarity economy initiatives and scale, the first thing that comes to our minds is that these are very local, based on solidarity, very small scale. It's almost an automatic connection. On the other hand, from a capitalist discourse, SSE and everything that is so small and local, etc., is seen as inferior in terms of efficiency, rationality, universality, productivity. So we seem to have accepted to some point that to be effective, SSE initiatives have to grow. My question is this true, and should they? And what happens when they do? So I'm going to look into the challenges, the gains, and how this affects especially social cohesion and economic impact. I'm going to borrow heavily from three authors and bodies of literature. The first one is Frank Mollert, in which he emphasizes that social and solidarity economy initiatives are a combination of two basic elements. The first one is the institutional innovation, and the second one is the values, social justice, embeddedness, solidarities, and so on, into the satisfaction of needs at the local level. When I refer to institutional innovation, I will define them as the socially embedded rules of human interaction. So it's basically, to some extent, a synonym of rules. I will borrow from North, who distinguishes between personal and impersonal exchange. Personal exchange is typical of small groups in which transactions go relatively smoothly because agents have a deep knowledge of each other. There's trust. transactions are relatively simple, whereas in personal exchange is typical of larger groups in which we don't really know who we are exchanging with. And this raises, of course, issues of trust, transaction costs, etc., etc. And the third source is Uzi and Etzioni, and they actually studied specifically the issue of trust and how trust is dealt with when there are newcomers into a network. So we go from a small network with a high level of trust to expanding this network. How does this happen? Well, Uzi says if a person refers a newcomer, we automatically transfer the trust in the person we know to the newcomer just because it's referred by somebody we already trust. Yes. Okay, so I did fieldwork in 2004 and 6 in three cities in Argentina with more than 1 million inhabitants. I visited 44 exchange centers. I surveyed 368 traders or agents, and I interviewed extensively the organizers of the scheme. Just to give you a very, very brief history of what DRT is, for those that hear this for the first time, it started in 1995. They used currency, a local kind of currency. I will show you some pictures in a minute. They used a unit of account, which was called créditos, and it was equivalent at that time to $1 or $1. It had at some point 2.5 million users at its maximum point. The accuracy of this figure, I would not bet on it, because there are some sources that talk about 2.5 million users, others about 6 million. It's unknowable. It's absolutely impossible to know how many they were, but certainly it was in the range of a few million. However, in 2006, this scheme entered a very, very quick demise. Again, on this paper, I will not refer to this point. And there was a combination of all sorts of schemes. It was a very interesting laboratory for complementary and community currency schemes. Some of them, some groups, were organized exclusively at the local level. Others were organized at the regional level, articulated, and a couple of them were even national. So you could go 5,000 kilometers with your funny money and still be able to buy something. The majority of the people that participated were the disenfranchised middle class, although I would dispute that there was quite an interesting mix in terms of class and social segment and so on. I will add also that the majority were women. So this is what it looks like, basically like any other very big market in which you can buy all sorts of things and sell, obviously. This is what the currency looks like. My favorite one is this one with a cat. Somebody, the organizer, liked his cat very much, and he decided to put a photograph of his cat. And this was money, no? Right? Non-state means of payment. And this is what the evolution in terms of membership looks like. For people that specialize in social movements, what is interesting is this is the kind of evolution we expect to see in a social movement. However, in the case of the Redes de Trueque, this was a market where people exchanged goods and services. And at the point where there were the 2 million members, you could exchange from, well, dental care to holidays to handicrafts and whatever you can imagine. So I'm going to distinguish how, or to disclose how this process of scaling up happened. The first thing that is very important is that the main organizers, or the first organizers, had incorporated this discourse of scaling up. And this is something that they kept on repeating. They were very much convinced that the more, the broader variety and the more services you could, and goods and services you could find in the RT, the better. This was not something on which there was much reflection. So they constructed a discourse that actually structured the agents as well into believing that scaling up was definitely a good thing, and it had to be done, and it was beneficial for everybody. So in the first wave of scaling up was to make the first city, the first center, larger. They started with 25 members. Very quickly, they grew to 60. And this was still easy. It was still within the scale of personal exchange. But then, at some point, they said, well, it doesn't make sense in a city like Buenos Aires, 13 million people, to travel 2 hours to go and sell your bread. Let's better replicate it to various points in the city. So they started trying to replicate the scheme, and they went from 1 to 2 and very quickly from 1 to 3. Now, they decided to stay interconnected, which meant that you could go from one center with your notes, your vouchers, to another one, and the various vouchers would be accepted in any of the centers. And this was the first decision they had to make. Until then, with personal exchange, they did not use any printed money, any vouchers. But at this point, three centers, a couple of hundred people, they needed a more efficient means of exchange, means of payment. That was the point when they printed the vouchers. And when there were newcomers, they transferred it pretty much in the way that UCI has researched in a completely different context. If you come into the club and you are referred by somebody I trust, then I trust you. So to this point, the scaling up was not too conflictive. Okay, now we go from the 2 to 5 centers. And this is when we start having problems because it was no longer possible for everybody to know and to trust everybody else. But still, they kind of know or had heard about the organizers, so their reputation did keep the thing running. And there was an assumption of solidarity and shared values. Everybody that would come and trade into these clubs, into these centers, would kind of share the same values. This is not something they thought that required any verification. It was an assumption to which they realized much later, when it was too late, perhaps. And this is the point when they also needed to sit down and start negotiating and agreeing on specific points. The first important rule they made was to decide on how much money they had to bring into the system. They used to do this. A certain amount of money was brought into the system per new person. So the moment you came into the system, you received a small amount of money to start trading. Now, when they appeared in the TV, they went from 5 centers to a dozen, and a few dozens very quickly. And this is where all they had was impersonal institutions, and they had to sit down and start making rules. This is what Mollard says, we need to start personal exchange and knowing each other and trusting each other is not enough anymore. We need to be able to write down rules. There were all sorts of disputes, conflicts, and so on. So very quickly, they had to design a very imperfect system of conflict resolution. And this is where I see the limits to the scaling up of SSE. How to keep the institutional, the rule-making process alive. So I find that there are a few necessary conditions, not sufficient, but necessary conditions for SSE initiatives to be able to grow. The first one, of course, is the part of values. The sharing of a morality of solidarity and reciprocity, which can be extended to newcomers. However, this is not enough. Not because I share the same values with you, I will be able to trust you, much less do business with you. So this is one point on which I think referral, in the way that UCI describes it, was so important. The second point is the one of reputation of the leaders. When there is not enough trust, and especially on a voucher that has, in fact, no value whatsoever on its own, but it's based on a system of mutual credit. Who has been able to issue the voucher is a issue. It's a certainly very important. And people used to say, well, yeah, but this is the money that comes from somewhere. And the name and the reputation of this somebody tended to be enough when this was still manageable and relatively small. And the third one is the point of institutional innovation, which I think is one of the problems of upscaling SSE. To what extent can this be done by negotiation, by agreement, and afterwards by enforcement? How do we keep on making rules to be able to make the system more impersonal? And this is the point when I ask myself, if this is desirable in social and solidarity economy initiatives, which are supposed to be based on solidarity and the social relations that sustain it. So I'm a little bit skeptic. I think that SSEs can grow to a certain extent. And after that, they either cease to be what they are supposed to be, or they break up, which was the case of the RT. But like I'm saying, that was a much, much more complicated story that I would need perhaps a couple of hours to explain it. Thank you.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.